on adverse effects. Okay, before we get to that, there's been a lot of discussion at this council and in other venues over the amount of time that's been required for this amendment. And we have quite a number of people on the council that were not there when this was done. In fact, most of the people on the council were not there when it began. And I've detected over the last day or two some misconceptions on how this has proceeded over time. So I'm going to take a short time here to go through where we've came from and how we got to where we are now. Actually, the whole thing with habitat protection began with the Magnuson-Stevens reauthorization of 1996, which became known as the Sustainable Fisheries Act. The key part of that change in the law was that it added protection of essential fish habitat. It had been known for some time that fishery management, particularly in the Northeast, was not working. And it was also clearly understood that the missing link was some way of protecting habitat because fish need habitat. At the time, the only habitat that was really accessible to research was the benthic habitat, the bottom, and that was what was primarily focused upon. The Sustainable Fisheries Act didn't just add protection of EFH, it also gave detailed requirements on how we would proceed with that protection, very detailed requirements that were later added to through court action and by regulatory changes. It included regular five-year updates to the amendments, the omnibus amendments that were a part of protecting the habitat. With the New England Council, the original omnibus amendment to the various fishery management plans to protect habitat was produced in 1998. At that time, it was layered in with groundfish closures and became a little bit complicated because there was a great deal of court activity taking place at that time that involved an ultimate determination that the agency had failed to properly administer this and to protect habitat. So there was a great deal going on at that time and a major change in how we approached habitat. In February of 2004, as the five-year update, the New England Council initiated at that time Omnibus Amendment 2 to change fishery management plans to reflect the needs for updates in the maintenance of habitat. At that time, in February of 2004, they outlined a set of goals and objectives. And Michelle, can you put that up? I want to take a quick look at this because it's important that we understand what the original goals and objectives of this action were and what had to be done in order to meet these goals and objectives, and specifically the legal requirements under the Sustainable Fisheries Act. Okay, just run that up. Okay, under goals, first one, to redefine, refine, or update the identification and description of all EFH, et cetera. The second one was to identify, review, and update the major fishing activities that may adversely affect the EFH of those species managed by the council. Understand that we didn't know what those effects were at that time. The third was to identify, review, and update the major non-fishing activities that may adversely affect the EFH of those species. The fourth goal now was to identify and implement mechanisms to protect, conserve, and enhance the EFH of those species managed by the council. We had a long discussion of what enhance means because we really don't have any way to enhance habitat. But that shows you the kind of detail that we were required to get into. The fifth one, now it starts to get really tricky. The fifth one was to define metrics for achieving the requirements to minimize adverse impacts to the extent practicable. We didn't really have any metrics. Nobody had ever done that before. So we had nothing to start with. The The next one was to integrate and optimize measures to minimize the adverse impacts we have faced across all council-managed FMPs. Seventh was to update research and information needs. Eighth was to review and update prey species information. And then by 2007, they had added to that the protection of deep-sea corals and their habitats throughout the Northeast region from fishing impacts. And this one we really didn't know how to handle. Under objectives, as we look down through that, identify new data sources and assimilate into the process to meet goals, state, federal, and other data sources. That became a mammoth task. And B, implement review of existing HAPCs and consider modified or additional HAPCs. C, review EFH designations and refine or redefine where appropriate as improved data and analysis become available. So in other words, we had to have a continuous process of bringing in new data to continue a continuing review. D became the real hang-up. Develop analytical tools for designation of EFH, minimization of adverse impacts, and monitoring the effectiveness of measures designed to protect habitat. That's Goal L, Goal 3, and Goal 5 all required this. There were none. When we started, there were no analytical tools available anyplace on the planet to do this kind of work. It had never been done before. E, modify fishing methods and create incentives to reduce the impacts on habitat associated with fishing. F, support restoration and rehabilitation of fish habitat, which have already been degraded by fishing and non-fishing activities. G, support creation and development of fish habitat where appropriate, and when increased fishery resources would benefit society. H, develop a strategy for prioritizing habitat protection. I, develop criteria for establishing and implementing dedicated habitat research areas. That's written right into it. I want to make that plain because we're going to get into that a little later. And J, design a system for monitoring and evaluating the benefits of EFH management actions, including dedicated habitat research areas. K, consider modifications to ground fish closed areas. That became a goal that was added later on. So that's what we were faced with at the beginning. And a number of decisions had to be made right off the top. The first one was, how do we do the metrics? And so the decision was made to develop the tools. And again, as I point out, this had never been done by any council before. People were pretty much waffling on this, and we were the first council to actually do it. Corals were then added in 2006, and they were added under Magnuson-Stevens Act, Section 305B, which was really a tough fit for us because we were only able to approach the coral problem by using EFH for species that we already managed. So somehow we wound up trying to stretch our EFH in order to include corals. And we wasted far too much time on that because the following year, the 2007 MSA reauthorization added specific provisions to do that under MSA 303B. So now we have responsibility under this action to protect corals under a different section of Magnuson than we had ever really operated on. And along the line, we also split the amendment into phase one, the EFH designations, and phase two, the adverse effects, because it was too big a job to do in one gulp. We just couldn't get our teeth around it and do it all at once. At this point, corals were kept in OA2 for convenience, although they were no longer under the SFA provisions that we had been operating under. And that's a key point with what we're doing with corals today. By 2007, we began phase two, and it was evident that we were not able to address Goal 5, Objective D. It simply wasn't doable without actually creating the tools. So we began with the idea of making a matrix that we could work with where we could look at a type of bottom and say, well, this is how we want to handle it, and then have some sort of a crossover arrangement so that we could say, well, if this species is found there, then we do this and all that kind of thing. Well, that began to grow. And when we added that to our data analysis and our literature search, it just kept growing. And it eventually grew into a really remarkable piece of work. I was very fortunate at this point because I got a chance to work with some truly brilliant people that put together a product that, when it was peer-reviewed, even the peer reviewers said that that regional councils aren't supposed to be able to do this kind of thing. So it was, for those of you who were here when we went through that, you know the kind of work that went into that. That went on for almost 4 years, developing the SASE model. And the SASE model became our primary tool for analyzing the effect of fishing and non-fishing activities on the benthic habitat. In fact, the SASE LISA process, which I don't want to get into today because we've exhaustively covered that over the last few years on the council, that became such an enormously useful tool that it's now being adopted by NAFO and in NAFO regulatory area. That paradigm is being adopted, and one of the creators of this tool, who's now out at the University of Alaska, is adapting it to use in the North Pacific. So it's going and it's moving and it's going to become the primary paradigm for managing benthic habitat. The SASE model was a tool to help us make decisions. Too often we had people going to it, and we have that happening today, going to SASE and saying, well, SASE tells us this or SASE tells us that. Advises us on how to proceed. Final decisions are still within the hands of the council, and we can make changes as we see fit. And in 2011, we then had one last expansion on the Habitat Amendment, and that was including the modification of the groundfish closed areas. So that gets us up to today, and that's a general overview of how we got to where we are now. The SASE LISA process has been enormously useful, but it needs to be continuously updated and upgraded, and we have to continuously research the data to tell us what we need to do. It's predictive in the sense it can tell us what kind of information we need to make it better, and it has the advantage of being perfectible. As we add new data to SASE, it absorbs it and gives us an automatic update in its output. So the next thing I'd like to do is to go to Michelle. Oh, any questions on that, by the way? Any comments? Okay. I'd like to go to Michelle. She's going to give you some background on the corals, and then we have a motion on corals.
Okay. So in your binders, the first document, number one, goes through the issue of splitting corals out of Omnibus Amendment 2 and putting them in a separate action. What you have in front of you is a short memo that outlines the issue, some of the things that have been discussed in the past by the committee, and this council also discussed that issue in June. And then there's a copy of the notice of intent that we published on July 27th, so just a couple of months ago now, that explains that the council is considering that decision and kind of some background and solicited comments from the public on that decision. We got two comments, which are also included in the packet. One was from Oceana, and the other was from the Natural Resources Defense Council, and both were in support. So I'm just going to run through kind of some of the major sort of rationales that were discussed most recently by the committee in terms of this. I think one of the primary, Dave mentioned that the sort of authority under which we can take action on corals has changed since the idea of coral protection was sort of first incorporated into the Omnibus EFH Amendment. During Phase 1, when the Council was presented with a series of habitat area particular concern proposals, many of those had coral protection kind of as a focus, and really at that point it was EFH and HAPCs and that authority that allowed the council to take some action in regards to coral protection. When these discretionary provisions were added in 2007, that kind of changed the game a bit. So the kind of major rationales that came out of some of the committee discussions were that removing these coral alternatives that are being developed under those discretionary provisions and putting them sort of separately will help facilitate completion of the EFH aspects of the omnibus amendment. The coral alternatives, you approved those in April. They, you know, do require further analysis, and we'd need to complete the elements of the EIS or EA document. And doing that additional work is just going to kind of take time away from completing the adverse effects minimization, groundfish elements, and other elements of the omnibus amendment. So that's kind of a primary reason for wanting to split them out. And it's also kind of just an issue of simplicity and kind of public clarity and kind of cutting down an otherwise very long action. Something else that's come up more recently, the sort of as we were, this council was discussing the range of coral options, because we manage fisheries all the way down to the Carolinas, we developed a range of coral options that covered that entire area. The Mid-Atlantic recognized this, and they decided earlier this year that they would initiate action on protecting corals within their region. And so there's kind of been some discussion back and forth about sort of sharing responsibility for coral management, and we're in the process of drafting and approving an MOU, which you'll see in just a minute. So kind of putting the coral alternatives into a separate standalone action is going to, I think, benefit us in terms of consulting with the Mid-Atlantic Council and sort of sharing advice and expertise and having meetings devoted to this topic and making sure that the right stakeholders are aware of what's going on and are focused, you know, just on the coral issues. Something else that was raised at the recent Habitat Committee meeting was the idea that the coral, most of the alternatives were basically designed to be outside of the footprint of most current fishing, and so kind of by their very nature will hopefully be a little bit easier to implement than some of the adverse effects alternatives that we're going to be talking about, perhaps a little bit less contentious. And so that's kind of an action that's can hopefully go through, you know, in a relatively streamlined way, and so it seemed natural to sort of separate that out from the rest of the EFH action. So those are some of the major points. There's some other discussion in this memo that you can read, and the things that were also discussed at the June council meeting. And so if we want to put up the first motion on corals, I think.
Okay. We got it. Okay, the motion is to split the coral alternatives out of the omnibus essential fish habitat amendment 2, with OA2 continuing to be the priority of the Habitat Committee and Plan Development Team. The rationale behind this is that we have a much more critical need with the original omnibus amendment, and we need to move that on to completion. Corals at this point, it's an important issue, but it never was really part of OA2 to begin with. We layered it in as a convenience, and now the convenience has become an albatross around our neck, and we're still going to complete it. It's mostly completed. We're still going to complete it, but it needs to go along a separate track. That's the basic rationale behind this, and we've discussed this before the council before, and that's the motion.
That's a committee motion. Doesn't need a second. You might just want to, I know you use OA2 as an acronym. You might want to do OHA just so everybody understands what it is. I'm going to go to the audience for comments. Gib?
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Gib Brogan with Oceana. We support this motion for all the reasons that Michelle just laid out. This is the right way to move forward. The one thing that we would hope that as the priorities process moves along for 2013, as they're laid out, the draft document that you'll be discussing this afternoon has corals as a secondary priority for 2013, and we hope that that stays. This is a good complement for the omnibus amendment, and when there are lulls in PDT time, we hope that this will continue to move forward and get some of the PDT resources. This is deep-sea corals are a priority, a national priority, laid out by the agency's habitat program specific for the Northeast region. The habitat blueprint has deep-sea corals in there, so we hope that this will continue to get the attention from the council and from the agency and move this as quickly as possible and let it move on its own. Thanks very much.
Drew.
Drew Minkiewicz, Fisheries Survival Fund, and I'll tell you just how good of a motion this is. I agree with Gibbs, so, you know, that happens every day. Moving this amendment forward as quickly as possible is critical. To give you some historical perspective, while I appreciate the chairman running through this timeline and why things are taking so long, to give you some perspective, in 1962, President Kennedy made a speech that we should land a man on the moon. A man walked on the moon in 1969. While this is difficult, it's not putting a man on the moon, and we did that in less time.
Anyone else? I can't see whose hand it is.
Jeff.
I wasn't looking over there. You're hiding in the corner.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I'm Jeff Kalin with Lunds Fisheries. I'm a Habitat AP advisor, AP member, and I just wonder, where does this go now? Because there are a couple of issues in terms of how extensive the coral protection zones are going to be that would have some significant impacts on some fisheries like squid, I'm thinking. So, where does this go? Where do we go to meetings to track coral when it gets taken out of the Habitat Amendment, which I am in favor of, by the way, to move the amendment? So where does this go? Thank you.
Habitat Committee.
As a separate action within Habitat. Okay, thank you. Yeah.
Anyone else? Back to the council. Dave Preble.
Yeah, thank you. Jeff, Kalin, I just wanted to respond to that. We have the coral action nearly completed, and Jeff is on the advisory panel, so you know he's going to be a part of that. I don't see it taking a long time, but it is going to take some time because it does have to be coordinated now with the councils, two of the councils to the south of us.
Anyone else on the council? I'm going to call the question. All those in favor of the motion? Dave.
Okay, the next issue is the Memorandum of Understanding, and I'm going to turn it over to Michelle to walk us through that. The MOU was initiated in order to be able to coordinate our activity on corals with the Mid-Atlantic Council and also the South Atlantic Council. The reason for that being that so many of the corals are in the deep water on the edge, and it's continuous along the entire shelf. It's not really something one council can handle. We ran into issues like exactly where the boundary line is between the jurisdiction of the councils. We had the boundary between the New England and the Mid-Atlantic Council went right through the middle of Alvin Canyon, a canyon that's near and dear to my heart, and we had to decide, you know, who's going to do it. So these kinds of things have to be worked out. And is Rick here?
Yes.
Yes. I would like to specifically thank Rick for his input into this and his willingness to help move this forward. The MOU has been placed before the Mid-Atlantic Council, and we're placing it before this council now so that we can get an interim approval so that we can an input from the council on any changes they want to see so that we can move it forward.
Oh. Okay, thanks. So you have this draft memorandum in your packet. It's document number 2. It's relatively short, so hopefully you all had a chance to look it over. I'd like to thank my colleague at the Mid-Atlantic Council, Hailey Dancy, for being the primary kind of author of this, with some input from those of us in New England and also in the South Atlantic. Just as kind of a preface, I think really what this will end up being is sort of an agreement with New England and the Mid-Atlantic being kind of the primary partners, especially from our perspective, because the fisheries that are in the New England region that overlap with other regions' fisheries are really overlapping with Mid-Atlantic managed fisheries. So we're talking about squid, red crab, things like that are in deep waters, kind of off the edge of the shelf and in the canyons. And then the South Atlantic, they were kind of brought into this because they have quite a lot of expertise in terms of developing management measures to protect deep sea corals. They've been doing this for quite a long time, and they actually have a coral-focused fishery management plan. And so the vision was to include them as a partner so that we could have kind of a mechanism for them to share their expertise with the other two Atlantic Coast Councils. So just to briefly kind of run through this document for you, there's two purposes. The first is to establish a framework for coordination and cooperation towards the protection of deep-sea corals. And the second is to clarify each council's role, and particularly the geographic areas of authority and responsibility with regard to deep-sea coral management. You know, I mentioned earlier the idea that, you know, originally we had started developing coral measures within the New England Council Habitat Omnibus Amendment for the entire coast. And so this memorandum would clarify that we're really focused on our region, which I think, as Dave mentioned, is sort of Alvin Canyon and kind of northeast, and then the Mid-Atlantic would be focused on their region, which is Alvin Canyon and to the border of North Carolina and Virginia. And then the South Atlantic has a number of measures in place south of there, within their area of jurisdiction. So the next section here just goes into a little bit of background about deep-sea corals, which I'm not going to read for you, but what we're talking about are kind of a group of organisms that are defined as being found at 50 meters or deeper. You know, that's not an absolute cutoff. Certainly sometimes you find these animals shallower than that, but by and large they're found in very deep waters, obviously. The exact species you find kind of depends on location and depth, and there's a number of different species in our region. We're finding new corals and corals that we didn't know were in certain locations all the time, and there's a lot of work that's ongoing. In terms of authority, if you could just scroll down a little bit, Karen, thank you. We also had discussed this earlier today, but there's a couple different places in the Magnuson Act that sort of provide a nexus to coral management. The most obvious at this point are the discretionary authorities that kind of allow councils broad latitude to take action to protect corals. And then the other sort of major authority is the EFH authority. Corals as structure-forming organisms certainly do. They're an element of the habitat for a number of fish species. Because they're in such deep waters, they don't have a huge overlap with a lot of the species that are, you know, commercially valuable in New England, but nonetheless there is a nexus. So those are the two primary things. And as I mentioned earlier, the alternatives that the range you approved in April, they've been developed by the Habitat Committee really with that discretionary authority in mind. They go into much deeper depths than we have EFH designated, for example. Scrolling down to the next section, Section D outlines what the council boundaries and geographic areas of responsibility actually are. And there is a figure that's part of, actually, I guess, document. It's at the end of the first document. So you can look. Where did it go? But it's just a map that will show you kind of where those coral... Sorry. So it's on page 4 of document 1. And you can kind of see it's shaded. It's not very easy to see on here, but this is the distinction, the division line between the New England and Mid-Atlantic Council regions. So when we talk about New England versus Mid-Atlantic, that's the area that we're referring to. And then finally, this the kind of meat of the agreement is in Section E, kind of what council coordination actually going to look like. So the goal is for the councils to seek continuity between core-related management measures in all of our regions. Obviously, that doesn't mean that the New England and Mid-Atlantic councils have to develop the same measures, but that we'll work back and forth, and to the extent that is possible, the goal, at least, if this MOU is adopted, would be to kind of seek kind of a consilience between the two councils' ranges of measures. And the reason behind that is because there are fisheries that operate in both regions, and the goal is to have consistency for the members of those industries wherever they're operating. Another element of coordination is sharing of data and information and kind of coordinating, helping each other to develop these measures and analyze these measures. Our habitat plan development team has already done a lot of work on this, and we've looked at reviewing coral data, environmental data, and other things for coral, what we think are coral important coral habitats up and down the coast, and we're going to be sharing that with the Mid-Atlantic. So it's going to include things like data on corals, data on fishing effort, geographic information system resources, that kind of thing. And in terms of some other specific elements of coordination, we'll be attending each other's meetings, kind of keeping up with each other's processes. And the South Atlantic in particular, what we envisioned is that they're going to sort of play an advisory role based on both their knowledge of corals, but also the expertise they've gained in terms of developing management measures specifically for coral protection. There's a lot of parallels between what is in place in the South Atlantic and the types of issues we're going to face here. You know, what research do you have and how do you turn information about corals into potential fishery management zones? How do you provide for certain types of fishing access in those zones via access programs and that kind of thing? So I think there's a lot we have taken from them and that we can continue to learn from them. So that's why that's important to have, we thought. And then the rest of it is just kind of saying that, you know, all the parties are independent. This isn't, you know, intended to be sort of that one party would have control over the other, that obviously any work that's done pursuant to this MOU is going to be dependent on availability of funds and personnel, which relates to other council priorities for all the councils. And then it just provides a place for the parties to sign. So that's pretty much everything that's in there, and I'm happy to try and answer any questions if people have them. And also that if there are any comments from the council about, you know, issues with, you know, language or edits, I think that you would like to see, that's certainly something we can take back to the Mid-Atlantic and the South Atlantic. It's possible the Mid-Atlantic may look at this again in the fall, and then the South Atlantic is going to kind of put this through their advisory panel and their oversight committee that's related to this topic, and then their council is planning to look on it at it before the year is out. So I don't exactly know how the sort of formal approval process will go, but all the councils kind of have been working on this and looking at this, and the idea today was to kind of get our council's feedback and try to keep the ball rolling on the issue. So.
Dave?
Yeah, one of the things that really brought this to a head was when we realized that in New England, southern New England, we have a very large offshore squid fishery. And these people work right out in the area where the coral zones will be established. And we need to have consilience among these councils so that a guy with a 135-foot vessel who's squid fishing and following a contour doesn't find himself suddenly, by crossing a political boundary, suddenly in violation because their depth rule is different. So this is the kind of thing that we realized we had to work together with other councils. It's sort of a new thing, and we're I guess sort of making it up as we go, but it's working out. And what we need is to get this council to review this and approve it as it stands right now. And we have a motion to that effect, which we can put up right now. motion? Okay. The motion is to recommend the council endorse the MOU as written, subject to approval of general counsel. The process isn't completed yet, but we need the approval of the council on where we are right now so that we can continue the negotiation with the other councils. They have to know that this council is on board with the process at this point. So that's the purpose for this motion.
And is this your motion or a committee motion?
Oh, this is a committee motion. I'm sorry. Okay. Yeah. Yes.
Well, what? No, I'm just looking at Gene to what have you looked over the MOU and
no.
And why does it need to be subject to your approval?
I don't know. Is this instructions you got from
the committee?
From the committee.
It's a quasi-legal document, and the thinking with the committee was that it needed to be reviewed, and that's how it was written.
Okay. I guess that I would entertain some fine-tuning of that motion. I can't do it, but. Dave Gaethel.
Yeah, council didn't attend the meeting, so we're not lawyers. We can't, put something forward unless somebody looks at it that's a lawyer and says, yeah, this is legal. And we don't, with no counsel there, that was the only way we figured we could word the motion.
David Pierce.
I would move to substitute that the council adopt the draft memorandum of understanding regarding the management of deep sea corals between the New England, Mid-Atlantic, and South Atlantic councils.
Seconded by Dave Preble.
Yes, I see that as an improvement, Mr. Chairman. The discussion at the committee meeting was that we needed legal advice, so that's why the committee wanted to put that in.
And I believe that's a motion to substitute. Okay. I'm going to go to the audience. Any discussion? Jeff?
Thank you, Mr. Chairman, members of the council. On E3, I don't see any mention of the coordination of the roles of the AP. The PDTs talked about, the committees are talked about, but I apologize. I saw this at the Mid-Atlantic Council, but I must have been asleep or something. But if you go to E3, authorities of whoever's there, the APs aren't identified, and it might be an improvement to make sure that the APs in these three councils are going to have a chance to cross-fertilize the options that are put before us. And there is no role for the AP in this document. Thank you.
Just a comment. The APs serve at the pleasure of the chair of the individual committees.
So a memorandum between three councils would not clarify that the AP is going to be specifically involved in determining having some voice in what the outcomes are going to be?
Well, historically, the process has been that the committee chair determines, when it is appropriate to get the APs involved.
When it is or is not, perhaps. So I just wanted to raise the issue. We spend a lot of time as AP members. We're either going to be part of the process or we're not. And that makes me uncomfortable. That's why I asked earlier, where is this going to go? Some of those coral protection options are a big problem for the squid fishery, and I just want to make sure, maybe this council will invite us, but this is three councils now, and I think it's a deficiency. I've made my point, and I appreciate the chance to do that. Thank you.
Anyone else? back to the council? Dave Preble.
Yes, thank you, Mr. Chairman. As a matter of policy, Jeff, I would not entertain any specific management action under this MOU that did not include input from the AP. That just seems to be a no-brainer. Well, the MOU is...
Chairman Robbins.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. We did have the benefit of reviewing this at our August meeting as a council, and I just wanted to point out that there weren't any significant legal questions raised in that discussion. We had general counsel at the table, but we did do some editing of the document. They were all relatively minor. I would just point out in response to Jeff's question, explicitly up there in the first part of E, in E1, it says that we would consider fishery overlap and engagement of stakeholders outside of the management region in the development of management measures. And I think that really gets back to this issue of the extent to which we have really a high degree of overlap in some of our fisheries between our councils that go across the council boundaries. And so, it just, again, underscores the importance of having a coordinated approach to this question. I think the MOU does a nice job of identifying coordination as a priority and then laying out the mechanics by which we might do that. It further delineates the areas of responsibility between the councils. And I think that was really necessary given where the discussion had gone, because this goes back to a discussion we had several years ago at NRCC about beginning to explore the authority for management of deep sea corals and the need to consider moving in that direction. And then the Habitat PDT for this council had done the development of some management options for areas that went all the way to North Carolina. So I think the time was right to consider developing this document. Hopefully it does this fairly clearly, and I think the draft that you have before you does that.
Anyone else on the council? Dave Gaethel.
I'm going to reiterate again. I mean, this is a contract. I mean, most people have a lawyer read a contract and make sure that it does what this council thinks it's entering into. So I'll vote for the motion, but I think it should still be reviewed by somebody to make sure that, we have done an adequate job of saying what we mean.
Anyone else? Call the question. All those in favor of the motion? Dave.
Okay, thank you, Mr. Chairman. The last item is the update on the alternatives. There's no future council, no other council action required today, except for your input on the alternatives as they're presented. The council has not seen these alternatives yet, and these are what we're moving with.
Okay. On back to the main motion. Those who support the motion as substitute, please indicate so. Those opposed, and those abstaining. Motion carries 16-0-0. You're on, Dave.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman, Vice Chairman. The next thing is the alternatives update. We have taken an immense amount of material and finally distilled it into alternatives for the our legal requirement to mitigate adverse effects on habitat. Go ahead, Michelle.
Thanks. So there's a presentation. There's a couple things in your binder on this topic. There's a document, number 3, that goes through these alternatives in some detail, provides a number of maps, coordinates for the different areas, kind of some rationale and discussions that have been had at the committee and the plan development team level. So hopefully if there's sort of detailed questions about any of these options, they can be addressed in this document, or I'm happy to take them as well. And then the presentation is a separate document, number 5. And really what I was trying to do when I put this together was sort of tell the story of how we got to where we are in terms of the range of adverse effects minimization options and how they were combined into alternatives. There's two things that we were hoping for the council to get out of today's discussion. And the first was just kind of to bring everybody up to speed on what the Habitat Committee has been working on in this regard, and also to provide an opportunity for sort of early feedback. I'm going to go through sort of at the end of this presentation kind of what are the next steps in terms of coordinating with the groundfish elements of the process, and then bringing the council a set of alternatives for adoption that encompasses both groundfish and habitat consideration. So a lot of this can be kind of gone through really quickly because Dave touched on a number of these topics already, but I'm just going to highlight some of the relevant goals and objectives that relate to the adverse effects minimization options and alternatives, go through some highlights of the SASE approach, and mostly providing this kind of for reference for those of you who weren't a part of the council when we developed that model and when we first started using it to develop options. Then kind of explaining sort of how we went from the outputs of SASE to a set of management options, and then specifically going through the different areas and what the options are for those, and then what are the next steps. I'm not going to read these again. You can read them on the slide. But the kind of the main thing is that the council in Omnibus Amendment 2 wanted to think about integrating adverse effects minimization across all its FMPs, and so that's why we developed this swept area seabed impact approach that considers all gears and sort of all habitats and areas, and was designed to help us identify sort of focus areas for further investigation and work. So the figure shows you the domain of SASE, which is actually quite large, and it encompasses basically all the fishing effort that's bottom tending in the Northeast region. We spent between 3 and 4 years developing this approach. I should really say late 2007, and we presented the local indicators, fishing association results that come out of this model to the Habitat Committee in June of 2010. The purpose of SASE is to allow us, again, to compare fishing impacts across different types of gears and across different areas. There's a number of elements of the approach. There was a vulnerability assessment, which was really literature-based, but we went from, it kind of goes beyond just a literature review, and it kind of was a sort of standardized approach where we made an attempt to fill in information that we didn't know and highlight uncertainties. So, you know, what do we understand about the impacts of fixed gears on different types of habitat features and that kind of thing? And it going through that process kind of really allowed us to identify what we know and what we don't know. There's obviously a large spatial component to the SASE approach. Within this domain, we look at what are the underlying substrates, what is it a high or a low energy area, and then what is the fishing effort in that area. And the output resolution of SASE is at 100 kilometer squared resolution, and I think as we go forward in this process, that's something to kind of think about and keep in mind, because some of the areas that have been proposed through the PDT and advisory panel committee process are larger than that, and some are kind of around that same spatial scale. So something we're going to need to wrestle with is sort of how do we use these quantitative results in a way that kind of matches the resolution of the areas we're looking at. And this it may get a little tricky. So what goes into the SASE model? Fishing effort by a number of different gear types. We have data which is really based on the trip report data set from 96 through the present. And so that's on that regular grid that I talked about. That's 100 kilometers squared per cell. We also have energy, substrate, and some inferred structural features that feed into the base of the model. These are just some graphical depictions of those. On the left, you see trawl fishing effort in, I think, 2010. And the darker colors are higher concentrations of effort. On the top right, you see which areas are classified as low or high energy. Obviously, it's really a gradient, but for modeling purposes, it's one or the other. And then the bottom right panel shows you the sediment classification that goes into SASE. The outputs at the scale of the 100-kilometer grid include a few different things. The first one, the vulnerability, is really what we, and then those clusters of those vulnerability outputs are really what we focused on when we developed this range of options. And then also something that will sort of come more into play as we move forward with the analysis of the impacts of these options in terms of habitat are what are the past and kind of future projected realized adverse effects when you take into account where fishing is occurring and the density of that fishing effort. And then something else that's been developed is kind of looking and trying to draw a comparison between the underlying habitat characteristics and their vulnerability, and then also the amount of effort and the value in terms of revenue that's coming out of those areas. And, you know, this is kind of one of the many tools we can use in the analysis to help us evaluate trade-offs between habitat protection and revenues and economic considerations and social considerations. So these just are kind of a graphical depiction of some of the outputs. On the left, this is kind of the analog to the distribution of the trawl fishing effort that was in the top left panel of the other slide. But rather than effort, this shows you the realized, what we project as the adverse effects to benthic habitats from that gear type. So it's kind of a generic trawl. It doesn't include shrimp and squid and raised foot rope trawls, but all other trawling effort in the region. And the reason that it's kind of more filled in than the single year of just the regular area swept is that SASE makes an assumption that impact will occur in 1 year, and then depending on the habitat types and the associated features, that impact will sort of continue until those habitat features recover. And so you have this kind of retained habitat impact that kind of moves its way through the model over time. We have some simulations that are kind of graphical images that show you kind of how that changes over time that I think I've shown at previous council meetings, or maybe Chad did. On the top right, you can see the sort of fishing density independent look at where are the vulnerable habitats. And so what's really coming out here is if you have that gear type and it interacted evenly sort of across the model domain at depths at which we think it can operate, so that's why it doesn't go all the way out to the EEZ and fill in the whole domain, which are the areas that are going to be most vulnerable to that gear type. And so the areas that we predict would be most vulnerable are the redder colors, and then the areas that are predicted to be less vulnerable are the bluer colors. And then on the bottom right, it's basically the clustered output. Running the top right panel through the clustering analysis, and that kind of asks the question of, so which of those cells in the top right are the highest vulnerability locations? And then what it really focuses on is, okay, well, which of those are near other cells that are also high vulnerability? And the reason we took that step rather than just trying to look at the top right panel, look at the raw outputs, was because in terms of area-based management, you're interested in which cells are adjacent to each other and cluster together and might make sense as kind of a larger management area. So I'm not going to spend a whole lot of time on this because I think we've sort of been through this before, and some of this came out in the various peer reviews. But really the main results were that the features associated with gravels come out as having a higher vulnerability. And then also the gears that sweep more area have a greater kind of magnitude of impact overall, and then the mobile gears are having a greater per unit area impact than the various fixed gears. So in terms of which of the many outputs of SASE to focus on when trying to develop a range of management measures, we were looking at the mobile gear SASE outputs. We assumed that kind of through the process of doing the literature review, the PDT had no reason to consider that or to make the estimate that trawl and scallop dredge gears had a different per unit area impact from one another. So the outputs of the model for those two gear types are very much the same. So we focused on the trawl outputs, but we could have done it the other way. So that's kind of what we used as sort of a starting point for developing a range of management alternatives. So there's a couple of objectives that kind of follow directly from the results that we saw out of the swept area seabed impact approach. And they're basically and these were kind of the objectives that the PDT, I think, had in mind as we were recommending a range of options to the committee. And those were to figure out where are the most vulnerable habitats, either because SASE indicates that they are, because we know that vulnerable habitat types occur in other areas, and maybe we know that there are some issues with, say, the underlying model grid. And so we wanted to bring in other data to make that inference. So the first objective is to figure out which of those areas are most vulnerable and try and come up with a way to protect those from the adverse effects of fishing. And then the second thing that comes out of the model is that part of what's driving the overall magnitude of adverse effects of fishing on EFH in our region is how much bottom is being contacted by various gear types. And so one way to try and reduce overall adverse effects of fishing on habitat is to reduce seabed area swept. And there's various different ways you could conceive of doing that. One is to shift to gear types that sweep less area, modify gear types, et cetera. And then another is to really try and focus on high catch per unit for fishing, which is going to allow you to take the same catch while reducing area swept. Obviously, there's a lot that goes into changing management systems to facilitate that goes well beyond what can be designed into the omnibus habitat amendment. So once we had the basic SASE results and the LISA outputs, we provided the committee with an assessment of what's the vulnerability of our existing habitat closures. We tried to characterize for the committee what's going on in terms of there was actually seven major of those LISA clusters that came out of the trawl outputs. So we talked about, you know, how dense are the data points in those areas? Were the sampling gears able to actually sample all of the substrate categories, or were they just focused on soft sediments? Things like that. And then also, you know, how deep are these areas? Are they high or low energy? What habitat types do we think are there? That kind of thing. And so kind of going through that process, we identified some other pieces of information that we felt were relevant and important, and kind of combined the LISA outputs with this additional information to come up with a set of areas that we wanted to recommend to the committee for potential management action. And so in some of the different documents and meeting summaries, you'll see those referred to as vulnerable areas. And sort of after we presented that to the committee, we've kind of gone back and forth over the past 12 months or so to kind of refine the different areas and think about what the boundaries should be with each of the areas, what habitat types we're really trying to focus on, and how does that balance with potential kind of resource access considerations. So the left-hand panel there with the sort of blue-green areas is kind of where the PDT started in terms of saying to the committee, here's the areas that the SASE model indicates to us or this, you know, additional extra SASE information indicates that are likely more vulnerable to fishing than average. And so these are areas where you might want to develop some options to minimize adverse effects. And so where we are now is the right-hand panel. And I'm just going to go through quickly what those different options are, because obviously they're a little hard to see on the two smaller figures. So these are the current habitat areas. This excludes the two canyon areas, the Lydonia and Oceanographer Canyon, which really have a better nexus with corals and haven't really received a lot of discussion in an adverse effects minimization context at the committee level. So starting from the north, Jeffrey's Bank, it's a There's no ground fish mortality closure in that location. It's just a habitat closure from Amendment 13, and there's an option to maintain it the way it's shown here or to modify it, which you'll see on the next slide. The Caches Ledge area, that's the existing closure. I know it's not really in context, so you can't kind of see how large or small it is. There's an option to maintain it the way it is or to modify the western boundary and move it eastward. The Western Gulf of Maine, there's an option in the document to maintain it the way it is, to eliminate it, and there's kind of two options to modify it, to focus just on Jeffrey's Ledge or to focus better on Stellwagen Bank, and with both of those, the modifications kind of eliminate the parts that are in really in deeper waters and focus in on the gravel habitats on the top of the Stellwagen Bank and on top of Jeffrey's Ledge. Closed area 1, 2, and the Lightship closed area have an option to maintain them the way they are to eliminate them. So just to go into detail about some of the newer areas, this is Jeffrey's Bank. You can see just the outline. This one, this is the current area, and then the shaded area is the new area. We have some data that indicate boulder and other types of larger grain size substrates that we think are harboring the sort of more vulnerable epifauna. And so those are in these kind of shallower areas, sort of on the tops of the bank there. And so this modified area is designed to really encompass those shallower locations. The Caches Ledge region, there's a couple of different things going on. So this is the existing Caches Ledge habitat closure. This is the Caches Ledge groundfish mortality closure. Some of the modifications that were suggested by the committee would be to shift this boundary here. This is the 100-meter curve, and that really kind of captures where the ledge is. And then this is mostly deeper waters over here to the west, and so there's a suggestion to modify that boundary. This yellow area here is the shallowest part of Caches Ledge, and there's a lot of concentration of kelp habitat there, and it's a very unique place in the Gulf of Maine, and so there's a suggestion to have enhanced protections here in this Ammon Rock area. And then finally, this is Fippenys Ledge. We'd kind of gone back and forth with a sort of a range of different options for Fippenys, you know, based on depth. And this option here really focuses on the areas where we have optical sampling that indicates large grain-sized substrates occurring there and the features that would be associated with those that are more vulnerable to fishing. This is a Platts Bank. So there's basically sort of two kind of shallow high points on Platts Bank, and those that have those, again, habitat types with the substrate types that we would expect to be more vulnerable to fishing gear impacts. And so this option is kind of a combination of these two areas and to focus on those types of substrates. And this area is currently open to fishing, whereas the previous Fippenys as part of the groundfish mortality closure is now pretty much closed, which is why it was called out in the groundfish committee motion that was discussed earlier. Here's Jeffrey's Ledge. This is the northern part of the Western Gulf of Maine habitat closure. Where's my pointer? So you can see, I mean, I'm sure many of you are familiar with kind of the shape of the ledge, but this, you know, is shallower, and it has the kinds of substrates that and associated fauna that we believe are more vulnerable to fishing. This northern sort of western part of the Jeffrey's Ledge area is deeper. It's more dominated by muddy substrates. Historically, there was some shrimping effort there amongst other types of fishing activities. So this modification is designed to really focus on the shallower, harder bottomed areas and to open up to mobile gear fishing the deeper, muddier areas to the northwest. This is part of sort of the northeastern part of Stellwagen Bank. Part of the bank is kind of off of the slide, but the shaded area basically is a sort of subset of the current Western Gulf of Maine habitat closure. And the reason it doesn't go all the way quite to the boundary of the current closure is that We have a multi-beam map of this area that basically goes to here, and so, and also it starts to get a bit deeper once you go past this, but the our sort of best knowledge about where hard bottom is within this region is within the domain of that multi-beam sampling. And so we felt most confident in recommending within that area as an adverse effects minimization alternative. Moving on to Georges Bank. So this is the northern edge of the bank, which I'm sure will receive some additional discussion today. This is the top of closed area 2, and the this area here is both a habitat closure and a habitat area of particular concern. And then to the west of here, Georges Shoal itself is somewhere around here, but all these areas actually were given the name Georges Shoal. And so this is the what's referred to as the Georges Shoal East area. This is the Georges Shoal West area. And then this is a kind of a large area that encompasses both. This large area is unique amongst the areas I've discussed today in that it's only proposed as a ground cable length limited area. And so the idea here, and we're going to be working on this next month with the advisory panel and the PDT, is to figure out what would be an appropriate maximum ground cable length. And by setting that maximum ground cable length, the concept would be that you'd be sort of reducing the linear effective width of the gear. And if catchability were the same, then you would end up reducing area swept overall. So there's a lot of different assumptions that go into that type of an analysis to develop those alternatives. That's what we're going to hopefully kind of work through with the advisory panel. But in any case, this larger area is designed with that in mind, whereas there would be an option to either do that kind of a ground cable modification or a mobile gear closure in these darker colored areas. Oops, wrong way. Sort of between the Nantucket Lightship closure and closed area 1, kind of east of Cape Cod and sort of west of the deepest part of the Great South Channel, there's a few different areas that were designed around where we find boulder and other types of substrates. These are shown here. I attempted to give them names that would hopefully be sort of relevant to people rather than Great South Channel 1, 2, 3, and 4. and again, the alternatives for these areas are either to have them as a mobile bottom tending gear closure or as these ground cable length limited areas. And what's been discussed by the committee for all of these areas is that for locations that have one or more sub-areas like Platts Bank or like Georges Shoal or like here in the channel, that you could sort of mix and match and have one or more of these. And the way that the PDT is going to be, at least at this stage, analyzing them is individually and trying to characterize the sort of potential habitat benefits that would be associated with management areas in each of these individually. And then as we go forward in the analysis with groups of alternatives, we'll try and get at what would some of the cumulative effects be. And then finally, furthest to the south, this is Cox's Ledge. So you can kind of see where we are for reference if you're not familiar. Currently, Cox's Ledge is this area is also currently open to fishing, as is Georges Shoal. Cox's Ledge is really this kind of southwestern area, and then this is what's been called 19 Fathom Bank. And originally we had kind of one larger area that incorporated one of the LISA clusters that came out of the SASE outputs, and then really wanted to focus on the two areas most likely to contain those substrates and habitat types of interest. And again, this has the potential for mobile bottom tending gear closure options or these ground cable length modifications.
I'm going to ask if we, I know that this is informational, but if there's going to be some time for feedback, I'm going to ask that we get it wrapped up in the next 15 minutes.
Yeah, I just have a couple more things. So something that the committee did last month was to sort of bring these options together and start to get some kind of sense of how they would like to see them implemented in combination. So this is, you've seen this earlier, this is the no action option with the current areas. These are all of the, either the modifications, so the modifications of Jeffrey's Bank or Cash's Ledge or the Western Gulf of Maine combined with the new areas. And they're listed there, and they're the ones I just explained. And then alternative three would be some subset of those either new or modified options. And the idea was to go forward. I mean, and all this is kind of pending on what happens through the groundfish element of the process and what kind of advice we get there, but to kind of go forward with an alternative that includes all the options, get some public comment, and then sort of select from those after public comment. The next steps, as was mentioned, was to review the feasibility of the ground cable length limit options. Maybe those are appropriate for some areas and not others. Talk about the different species that might occur in those areas and what lengths might be appropriate, you know, in terms of the gear types that are already used and that would provide some habitat benefits. The PDT has been working on a range of dedicated habitat research area alternatives, and we are going to present those on the 10th, and then hopefully the committee can approve those at their next meeting, which hasn't been scheduled yet, but should be probably in November or December. The groundfish closed area technical team has been working on assembling information and developing objectives related to groundfish elements of area management. And so they're going to continue to do that work and present advice to the groundfish plan development team and committee. And then eventually, you know, early next year is what we're planning right now. There's going to be a joint process between the groundfish and the habitat committees to look at these areas that I've just shown you and also whatever range of area management options come out of the groundfish process and see how those overlap or don't and can be reconciled. And then those combined options will be packaged into alternatives and come back to the council for approval at some point next spring. So that's all I have. Thank you.
Okay, this was a very general overview of the options, and the there's a much more detailed look at it in the number three, enclosure number three, options and alternatives to minimize the effects of fishing on EFH. So open to questions or comments.
I'm going to start with Matt and then go to David Pierce.
Thank you, Michelle. This is an amazing, amazingly concise presentation about 8 years of work, which I think is remarkable. Someone who studies the history of ocean science, this is historical on its scale. I want to raise one quick question. Is there going to be analysis of how the SASE and LISA identified spots are going to match up with essential fish habitat areas? You're looking at vulnerability and substrate and energy levels, but I don't see that integrated with essential fish habitat designations. So I'm just wondering if there's any plans for that to come forward.
Yeah, that's something that, in particular, Dr. Stevenson from the regional office and I have been working on. I don't know that it's, and the PDT has been discussing this for a few months about whether it should be sort of a quantitative analysis or something more qualitative, and we came to the conclusion that qualitative was probably the way to go. But in evaluating each of these individual areas, they'll be characterized in terms of their physical and biological characteristics, but also which species have EFH there, and then of those species that, you know, have essential fish habitat there, because the areas are designed around gravel substrates, which of those species do we think are more closely associated with those substrates and benefit from those substrates? So not only which species are there and have EFH there, but which ones would you expect to benefit from these kind of management measures? That'll all be done, yeah.
And just one more quick follow-up. What's the status of the HAPC area for cod on the northeast tip there?
As part of phase one of the omnibus amendment, there were a number of HAPCs that were reviewed and kind of approved. I mean, final approval is kind of pending approval of the whole amendment, but as of right now, that's still in the mix as a habitat or a particular concern.
David Pierce.
Yeah, thanks, Michelle. On page 8 of your presentation, page 9 of your presentation, you've got a summary of the SASE results, and you highlight a very important thing, and that is, in the first bullet, features associated with gravel, and then it's defined, granule, pebble, cobble, and boulder, okay? These are the habitats, the gravel habitats, estimated to have higher vulnerability. So I see that, and then I go to the figure on page 6 to see where the gravel is located, and I note that the granule pebbles are dispersed far and wide. It's hard to tell in this particular figure because it's so small. But my question is, will there be provided to this council convincing information that we really do need to enact habitat protection areas, measures to protect habitat in locations where there are granule pebbles, which are very small? I don't believe they're capable of, well, they're not boulders and they're not cobbles with 3D life. It's a high-energy environment where things get swept away, such as the sand leaving behind the granules and the pebbles. So to me, that's going to be critical for this council to review as we get deeper into this very important work and then make decisions about what areas should be considered for special protection. So I would, this is just an advance warning, as I warned you maybe 3 years ago, please provide that information so I can be convinced that those areas warrant protection. The other areas, absolutely, but I need help with the convincing. Thank you.
Tom Dempsey.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I don't know, Michelle, you look sort of ready to respond to that. Did you want an opportunity to do that, or are you ready for another question? Okay. So some of these management alternatives include ground cable length limits, and you highlighted the fact that, obviously, given a shorter ground cable, you have sort of a less area, less impact. Is there any reason to think that the same wouldn't be true for a scallop dredge? In terms of a broader, wider scallop dredge would have significantly more impacts than a narrower one in the same way?
No, I mean, it's the same sort of basic concept, that narrower gear is going to have less of an impact, provided that your catch and your tow length is constant. That kind of makes sense. So, the outputs in SASE look separately at general category scallop gear and limited access scallop gear. And to my understanding, the limited access gear is fairly uniform in terms of the dredge width that's used. And then the smaller dredges are used with the smaller vessels. So in terms of sort of estimating past impacts and then forecasting future impacts, we're going to be looking at sort of the actual width of gears that are used in the fishery on different vessels and making those projections accounting for different gear widths. I don't know if that totally answers your question, but
I guess it does in part that those differences are expected to be based at least in part on the width of the gear. But in terms of management alternatives, at least what we've considered to date, while the analysis separates out general category or smaller dredge operations from larger dredge operations, the management measures allow for considering those impacts or considering the sort of consequences of those differential habitat impacts once we get to deciding what management measures we ultimately want? Or is that simply for mobile ground fish gear or dragger gear?
The committee hasn't discussed the idea of sort of, I mean, the idea behind the ground cable modification options would be to encourage people, if they're going to fish in areas that are thought to be more vulnerable, that they'd use gear that's narrower, has less of a footprint on the seabed, and assuming catchability remains constant, that you're going to have an overall reduction in the magnitude of gear impact on the bottom. The committee hasn't discussed the idea of sort of encouraging modifications to scallop dredge gear, but if an area is designated as a ground cable modification area, then there would be no management of what was envisioned is there'd be no management of scallop dredging in the area, so there are narrower gear by much narrower than trawl gears to begin with, so those would be just excluded from that type of a regime.
I have Laura Ramson and then John Bullard.
I just wanted to echo what Dr. Pierce said. As the same exact thing struck me is that there's a large difference between granular pebble, which I think of as one step above sand, versus cobble and boulder, which, frankly, the fishermen don't want to run their nets over. So I would definitely be looking for some explanation, because I think we need to be careful of the difference of nice to close versus must close, especially given the current environment. And I had one other. Oh, the other thing I wanted to say is, obviously, thank you very much for this report. I would echo comments earlier saying that you certainly synthesized a great deal of information. And it makes me quite hopeful about how much analysis has already been done, that it might be helpful for the service as they're evaluating whether to let the scallopers into the areas or the groundfish, that all of your legwork will certainly be helpful in those efforts. Thank you.
Quickly. Yeah, I think what's hard to see on any of these figures, and is something that will come out in the individual area characterizations, is that the areas that have been identified really do have a mix, for the most part, of, well, as far as I know, all of them do, of boulder and cobble substrates, kind of in a wider matrix of granule pebble and sand. And what we'll try and do in the impacts analysis is indicate, you know, what the proportions are of those different substrates and, you know, any uncertainty we have in those outputs and that kind of thing. But all these areas do, to my knowledge, incorporate some elements of cobble and boulder. So I don't think there are any areas that have been identified that really just focus on the really smaller gravels.
John Bullard.
Thanks. Dave, thank you very much for the explanation of the work and the outline of goals and objectives. It is a daunting task, and to pick up on a metaphor that Drew Mankiewicz mentioned about the man on the moon, I guess in part my questions are going to be a little bit, you know, when does the man on the moon land? But also, you know, I think part of the metaphor is that when Neil Armstrong walked on the moon, we didn't stop, you know, shooting rockets off into space. That was just an interim step. And so I want to get back to this sense of urgency. And that is, we don't have to have all of the information before we vote on a plan. We don't have to have all of the information before we see a plan that delineates essential fish habitat. You have a lot of information assembled. Now, before I took this job, I worked with Matt and others at Sea Education Association. I worked with John Weber, who addressed us yesterday or the day before on the Mass Ocean Plan. And State Representative John Quinn and other colleagues said we should have a Mass Ocean Plan somewhat similar to this. And he gave us 1 year to develop a Mass Ocean Plan for Massachusetts state waters, with the same daunting list of challenges, and said to John Weber and Darren Babb-Brott, you've got 1 year, deliver it, 1 year. And so we delivered it, 1 year. Now, that wasn't the end of our work. The work still goes on, and John Weber reported. Now it's an even more daunting task because it's federal water. Right, the work goes on. But at the end of 1 year, there was enough done so that lines could be drawn about, you know, special protected areas and where renewable energy should be done. But a deadline was done, 1 year. And so there's a lot of work that we have to do. There's a lot of work we have to do, and I would think that you have a lot of information that you've gathered in the time you've done so that boundaries are there. And I'm going to ask one of the great boomerang questions, because I know this one's coming right back at my head, and I'm going to duck, and it's going to hit Dr. Karp right behind me, which is, you know, when are we going to see, it's a two-part question, the second part is the boomerang, and I'm ducking, and it's going to hit Dr. Karp right behind me. When are we going to see a plan that we can vote on that establishes essential fish habitat? And what resources does the council need to speed this along so that we can vote on the omnibus habitat amendment as soon as possible so that we can get on to opening mortality closure areas, so that we can get on to seeing how we can open up the northern edge so that scallopers can get to areas with minimal yellowtail closure, so we can do this, because it all rests on this amendment. What can we do to speed this process along? And now I'm ducking.
Okay. First of all, the SASE model and the process that we're engaged upon right now. I'm going to take these one at a time. Is, and you're quite right, it's an interim thing. It's an interim by the legal standards. It's an interim process because every 5 years it has to be updated. As far as Drew's Man and the Moon is concerned, the analogy fails in one regard, and that is that John Kennedy had the resources of the most powerful government in the world, and he had major agencies that were involved. To be honest with you, and to lay it right out frankly, I've been trying for 5 years to get help from Michelle. And I've been all the way to the top of this agency to do so. And this is no indictment of Paul or anybody here, because he's done the best he could. But we have been trying for 5 years to get additional resources on this. And as far as the amendment itself is concerned, we're ready to go. The reason that we have the ground fish involvement is because, as a practical political matter, if we had come in to close new areas, we would be opening others. But those areas were already ground fish closures. So if I go to a fisherman and I say to him, well, yeah, we want this little area over here to close, and we're going to open this one over here, then he looks at it and says, well, okay, you opened it, but it's still closed. I still can't fish there. So what the fisherman sees is more habitat, more ground taken away. So it became necessary to get the ground fish involvement. Now we need the ground fish analysis and you know, if you look at the larger options and alternatives that we've got set up here for fishing on EFH, we're pretty much ready to go here. Once we get the ground fish analysis, this can all be put into options that come right before the council and out the door. That's what we need right now. But the idea that this was done over a 7-year period with poor little Michelle doing, you look at what she's turned out. Just take, you know, the stacks and stacks and stacks of stuff that's been turned out. And the SASE model, we weren't going to get into that today, and I didn't want to get into it very far. But when you look at the capability of that model, the first time that was run on the computer at Woods Hole, it was run at night because it shut down all the other computers. It took that much computer power. So these things have gone a long way with the resources we had at hand. Frankly, I've wanted to have this finished up for the last 4 years. And, you know, we don't have the resources that John Kennedy had to put a man on the moon. And I agree with you, it's an interim thing. As soon as we finish this and get it out the door, we finish the corals. And sometime over the next 5 years, we've got to renew this process. SASE it grows by itself if you keep adding data. The only major thing we have left to do right now, and it's not even that major thing because it's mostly done, is to research areas. And they're actually not so much research areas. They've been characterized by some people as playgrounds for scientists. They're not that at all. What we need to establish, and what's required in the law that we establish, is research areas that are for monitoring the effects of what we do. We can't be putting this kind of an amendment out to protect habitat with no metric to know 5 years from now whether it worked or not. This is the trap we get caught in. This is why we've got areas closed, like Nantucket Lightship area, closed Area 1 for habitat, that have no value at all. In fact, may have been counterproductive, because what they did was they moved effort into other areas. So you've had displacement of effort and a completely distorted situation. Now we've got the metric to take to do those measurements, but it has to, as you pointed out, it has to keep going and going and going. And we have the waypoints where we have to stop and say, here's where we make the decisions. We're there now, but we just need that last push with the input from primarily from the groundfish side of it. And all of these people have been completely occupied. But I sure would have liked to have had some help from Michelle 4 years ago.
John, did that answer all your questions?
Yes.
Okay. I see some hands down there. Mary Beth?
I just wanted to remind the chairman that I do have a motion from the Groundfish Committee that's pertinent to this discussion. And I also have, and I can make that motion on behalf of the committee. I also have given Karen another motion that would be just a motion from me that would answer John's question, maybe.
Okay, I'm going to take comments from Matt and Tom, and then and Chairman Robbins, and we're going to move on to the motions.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Director Bullard, I appreciate the call for urgency. Time is short. We need to act. But I've been hearing from industry for the very short time I've been on this council that the mortality closures were done without enough thinking put behind them. And as Dr. Preble has just said, they may have been misplaced. So, sorry, congratulations on the promotion. But, so I think we need to move quickly, but we need to think. We have a lot of information that needs to be considered properly. We need to consider how these areas will protect essential fish habitat as laid out in the law. And we need to move fast, prioritize this, yes, but we can't just jump because we need to jump right now, because we're trying to correct that from 15 years ago. The industry needs it for predictability and planning. We owe it to them. Thank you.
Tom Dempsey.
Thanks, Mr. Chairman. I'll keep this quick, and I definitely want to say that I appreciate John's question. And I think I'll take the opportunity to broaden it out a little bit. As a true partner with the council, I think the service has an opportunity to help us in a time where we have a real backlog of things that we need to deal with. I think we talked quite recently on the legal side of things of moving some folks around and putting some more resources in to clear a backlog. I think you could do that here. I mean, we're about to have a priorities discussion, and Paul, every time anybody brings something up, as is his role, is going to tell us all that there's no staff to do it. And we have actions backing up on top of each other. Now, we have a staff. I don't know how big the staff is, but it's a tiny percentage of what's at the regional office and certainly what's at the disposal of easy beck and call of the agency. So send 3, 4, 5 people, help us for a year and a half, clear the backlog of these FMPs, and we'll move forward. Right now, things are just backing up in the queue, and habitat is clearly first and foremost among them. We can all agree that we need to move forward on it, but there's other things that we need to do in some of these FMPs that have been sitting around for quite a while. An influx, a targeted effort would show, I think, a great partnership and would help us clear some of this backlog. And I'll talk your ear off about that if you're open to the suggestion.
Mary Beth.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Karen has called committee motion number 10, so I'm making this motion on behalf of the committee. Recommend that the council include development of escallop access areas and allocations in and around current EFH closures in the Habitat Omnibus Amendment, and recommend expediting submission of that action to the extent practicable. So even though the discussion has been about trying to move things along, ironically this would add something, but it adds something of great importance to the scallop industry. If we have an omnibus amendment that we could move it along and get it in place, and we haven't got this piece with it, the area would not be available for an access area to the scallop fishery.
Now that I read this a little more carefully, I'm not sure what it means when it says development of scallop access areas and allocations in and around current EFH closures in the Habitat Omnibus Amendment. I think I know what it is that is wanted out of this, but I'm...
I could just try to explain a little bit. To develop the access areas is to define the boundaries. Mm-hmm. To make the allocations would be to say, you know, if and when the northern edge, for example, should be available for an access area. These are the boundaries, and in 2013, the scallop industry could have one trip at 18,000 pounds. That would be the allocation piece.
I'm troubled by that because the access is one aspect that I think would be under the what goes on in the habitat, but for the habitat plan or committee to be developing allocations in the scallop fishery, I think that's problematic.
And so there have been discussions about that. Some of which happened after this, you know, motion. About exactly how you get this done, but the thinking was that certainly defining the boundaries and any allocations would have to be done by the scallop PDT, not by the habitat PDT, regardless of what action they would be in. There was some thinking, I think, on the part of the staff that it might be appropriate to only do the boundaries in the habitat and the allocations in some other action, but I did not feel comfortable as the chair of the scallop committee amending this motion. So I presented as it came up in our discussions.
Yeah, I mean, we would in order to do this, you'd have to actually have a joint action. I mean, it definitely would be cleaner to have the scallop committee have something that says, you know, if this is open, then under specifications, that this is what the allocation would be in that area.
And that also was discussed, whether or not we could put, preload framework 24 to do this. And I guess I would look to the staff on some of this, but I don't think that's really possible. So it's a timing issue, quite honestly. The other alternative, which I think the industry probably would not be very happy with, would be to finish framework 24 and initiate a new framework immediately following. But then again, you run into timing issues of something like that and the omnibus.
Jean, where this would be, in fact, a new allocation, are we running into problems there with an amendment versus a framework?
Yes, I think you are.
So I think that we're going to have to pair this back to the development of the scallop access areas. This is an amendment.
This is an amendment. Yeah. I mean, if you're asking if they separated it out, could they do it by framework? I think the answer is no. It would need to be an amendment. This is amending all of the plans. So theoretically, you know, it is a joint action already. But I take your point that I'm not sure the Habitat Committee should be determining the allocations for the Scout Committee. But it could be done jointly, and I think it... You know, I don't know if that's going to shorten the time frame for doing this, but
I'm going to let it go forward just as it is. I have Chairman Robbins.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I regret that I have to leave momentarily, but did want to speak to this motion. I had offered this at the scallop committee, and you know, I would just point out the intent of it was, it had several different purposes, and one is that as the Habitat Omnibus goes forward, if it results in the modifications of EFH areas such that areas like the Northern Edge are open, then we want to ensure that the access to the scallop resource in there is done in an orderly and controlled way. You wouldn't want that to simply become an open area the day that the Habitat Omnibus is implemented. It makes more sense that we would work to establish that right up front as an access area, as appropriate, based on the information the scientific information that's there in the Habitat Omnibus. The work for delineating that, though, I think would have to be done in consultation with and really primarily by the Scallop PDT in terms of delineating that boundary. Then the allocations, if the allocation for a trip is included in that, in the amendment, then that way when the amendment is implemented, it's turnkey. So you immediately have orderly access to an access area. You have an initial allocation. That allocation, as I envision it, would be subsequently amended through the next framework. So, you know, you'd go through the normal specification process in the out years in your framework and update the allocations for that area. That rotational area would be receiving a subsequent allocation in out years through the framework process. But, you know, it seems to me that you can include a specification measure like that in an amendment and front-load it so that when the amendment is implemented, those measures are in place. We discussed yesterday the fact that this can be a vehicle for delivering very important mitigations to the fishery. And all too often, I think, when we talk about mitigations, we're asked to either suspend our public trust responsibilities or set aside a stock assessment. That's not the case here. We have an opportunity to act on the best available science and significantly mitigate some of the impacts within the scallop fishery. There are also important implications for the groundfish fishery. And the scale of those impacts and the scale of the opportunity to mitigate those is unprecedented. So I think that ought to be reflected in the urgency and really the schedule that's assigned to moving forward with this. And I would not suggest that it be moved forward in any way that's incomplete or not yet ready for implementation, but rather that it be moved forward with all the resources necessary to make it happen in a timely way. Because, again, the consequences of it are so important. Structurally, I would think you could either put it in the amendment or put it in a trailing action, which would be a framework. But if it's done in a framework as a trailing action, you run the risk that the omnibus would be implemented and then the framework wouldn't come online in a timely way, and you could have a disorderly situation with respect to the access to that resource. So, again, I think just in the interest of making sure that when this does open, it opens in a way that makes sense, that's thought out, that's all orderly, is the best way to do it.
Thank you. Dave Gatel.
Yeah, now you know why man got to the moon first. He's going to be back to the moon before we get done. The problem here, number one, is the Habitat Omnibus Amendment was never scoped for allocations, so you're going to have to go back out to scoping. That's first and foremost right there. If you're going to keep the allocation in there. I think you can do the scallop access areas through Habitat, but the allocation, at least my understanding of an amendment, is it would have to be scoped. So that slows things down right off the bat.
David Pierce.
Yeah, when I first saw this motion, I thought it was an effort to prepare for the eventual opening of habitat closed areas, current habitat closed areas, as depicted in Map 15 on page 55 of the document that we've just referenced, in preparation for access, because right now, according to the assessment that we have seen and in some very informative figures that have been provided by the Scholar Plan Development Team, there is a tremendous amount of scallops available in those areas that are now closed because of habitat protection. So that was my thinking, that this is a way to begin to make that transition, to get ready to harvest those particular scallops, but in a reasonable and in a responsive way by having it be an access area and not just an area that opens up and everyone goes in and catches their scallops and wipes them out really quickly. That doesn't make any sense. So that was my thinking, that it was going to be that the scallop committee was going to develop this access area that is in the opened area for habitat protection, that it would not be done through the omnibus. I don't understand how we would do this through the omnibus amendment. The omnibus amendment will open up potentially that area in the northwest portion of closed area 2. Potentially it will close down or restrict access in major ways on Georgia Shoal East, Georgia Shoal Large, and Georgia Shoal West. Again, that's on page 55, map 15. So I guess I'm just looking for clarification because now I don't know what this motion really would lead us to do. I don't see the sense of or the need for us to take the Habitat Omnibus Amendment and to create a scallop access area within that amendment. Do you follow me, Mr. Chairman? It's the task of the scallop committee to develop the access area, which would be the current closed area in Area 2, prepare for that. So I guess I can't vote for the motion because I don't believe that it accomplishes what should be done for a quick preparation to gain access for the scallop fishery in that area on Georges that is currently closed for habitat, and it need not be closed for habitat according to the SASE model.
Gene, can I ask you your opinion as to whether, in fact, scoping would be needed in this situation?
I haven't reviewed the originals. I mean, recently the scoping documents. I'd want to look at them and see how it's described in there. So I can't give you an answer off the top of my head without. I mean, I can look into it, and it has to do with whether it's required by NEPA, not because it's an amendment under the Magnuson Act that scoping is required. And if this is an issue that was understood to be part of this, then you probably wouldn't need scoping. If it's a totally new concept that wasn't included in the scoping document, hasn't been discussed since, then there may be a problem, assuming, you know, because of NEPA concerns under for EISs.
I'm wondering, Mary Beth.
So perhaps one approach, Mr. Chairman, would be for us to consider this amendment, realizing that the allocation part might not be doable in the amendment, and get the advice that we need on some of that back to the scallop committee that meets on November, I think, 8th. Advise the committee that either that, yes, this motion is fine the way it went, or defining the boundaries can go in the amendment and the allocation can't.
Well, or you could put in, you know, language saying pending resolution of scoping problems or something of that sort. Date problem.
How much is this going to add to the time required to finish this 8-year-old amendment?
Paul.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. If I were a betting man, I'd say that this would not be the way I'd want to go. I think it would extend the time frame for scallopers to have the access that they expect to have. Seems to me that what I would do is, in your framework 24, say that closed area 2, the whole area, is closed until it's opened by scallop framework 25, and do the work yourself as opposed to doing it under the habitat amendment. The council staff recommended you do habitat alone and just close areas for habitat alone, and then have the ground fish and everything else follow suit, and then you use the habitat science. We would be done by now, but we're waiting on other things now. So it just doesn't work to do two things under one. It just doesn't.
Let me go to the audience for a comment. I'll start with Greg and then Drew and Ron.
And Gib after him.
Gib. Thank you, Mr. Chair. Greg Cunningham with the Conservation Law Foundation. I am, frankly, a little surprised to see this motion in light of what I've understood to be scallop industry desires for years to speed up the habitat amendment. This strikes me as another yoke on the shoulders of that amendment. Procedural complications are attached to it. I think there are legal complications associated with it. I'm quite certain that the scoping documents make no reference to allocations. And if that is the case, I think there is a real NEPA concern here. This, I agree with Paul Howard's statement to the effect that this ought to go through the scallop committee. It ought to be addressed where it is appropriate for the habitat committee to be either working jointly with the scallop committee or on its own, God forbid, making decisions related to scallop densities and or allocations, which I assume wouldn't be the case, but is setting us up for more delay in an amendment that I was very pleased to hear Administrator Bullard suggest needs to be expedited. I heard, to my dismay, earlier in the day, Mr. Howard, you suggested that the closed area technical team is not going to get to the omnibus habitat amendment work as a result of this sector's ops plan approach to accessing the closed areas. We are pushing this. We are simultaneously saying we want to get this thing done, and we're taking actions that put it off constantly. Those have been my observations in the 4 years I've been working on this, and this is another example of it. The Omnibus Habitat Amendment represents a certain degree of certainty for everyone, the industry included, as to where people can fish and what areas we ought to protect. We've advocated for some time it ought to be the mechanism that decides what areas are open and what areas are closed. This sector's ops approach is going to create a lot of uncertainty. If it's done appropriately, there's going to be a lot of uncertainty as to whether those get approved or not. And the Omnibus Habitat Amendment could relieve that uncertainty. All resources available should be put toward that amendment, and this approach will not contribute to any additional progress on it. We would urge you to please vote against it.
Drew.
Drew Minkiewicz, Fishery Survival Fund. We want this habitat amendment to pass as soon as possible, but the habitat amendment passing that doesn't then have an access area on the northern edge with an allocation is useless to the scallop fishery as far as actually then doing something good with that that opening. For the scallopers to be able to get this resource, be able to fish up to their ACT to a level of 0.28 rather than the level of 0.22 that we're looking at, the only way that can happen is open the habitat area, then have fishing effort allocated within an access area to allow that to happen. So just putting the habitat amendment forward without this step in lockstep with it does nothing to fix the problem, does nothing to alleviate $160 million lost in revenue. Scallop AP originally recommended and passed a motion to put into Framework 48 the access areas and the allocations with it in case the habitat area opened up. Staff and others from the day that happened on Monday, and in the intervening time, people said, no, put it into the amendment. So that's what the scallop committee did instead, said, and passed this motion. So I don't care how you all do it, but it's got to get done. If this doesn't work, can we please stop bickering about this, this, and that? Let's get to the work of actually getting solutions onto the table and put a motion forward that we can agree on that gets this done so that when this habitat amendment passes, and it's going to pass quickly because we're going to do it, then we can actually take advantage of that and have access areas and allocations in place. But if you just vote this amendment down because you don't think it works and you don't do anything, then you haven't done anything to alleviate the $160 million loss to the economy.
Ron.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Ron Smolitz, Fishery Survival Fund. You know, 8 years ago, I was against the omnibus amendment. I said it should be done in the individual fisheries management plans. I was against phase one and phase two. I said it's just like bycatch. You want to mitigate habitat impact, do it fishery by fishery. I was overruled. We went with the omnibus amendment. Now you're saying that we can't do the fishery by fishery changes within this omnibus amendment. I'm pretty sure scoping covered this. When we look at the areas on the northern edge, in the omnibus amendment, we're going to ask what actions are taken to protect that. And you're not going to have an answer for scallops because you don't have a measure. We think the most important thing is define a scallop access area out there, define that boundary, whether it's going to be at 68 or 6745 or 6730. And the work's going to be done by the scallop PDT. It cannot be done by the habitat PDT. We're supposed to be working together. These aren't separate entities. They work in the same damn office. We need the scallop PDT to do this. In the meetings last week, we'll never get the Framework 24 in place in time if we do it. However, come January and February, the pressure's off of them a little bit. They'll be available to do this, and we put it into the omnibus amendment. The way we're going to control habitat impact in the scallop fishery is high catch per unit effort, frequency, and intensity. I think you need that information in the omnibus amendment. You need to know what action the scallop fishery is going to take to minimize and mitigate its quote-unquote, potential adverse impacts. So you might as well do the analysis. The analysis is going to be done by the same group of people, the scallop PDT. Have them do it in January and February and put it in the amendment. If you think that they could do it in January, you can't. It's too late for that framework. We already know we need an annual framework with specifications. We can't drag that down, and it won't give us any relief for 2013. I just cannot imagine that there is a real reason why this cannot be done in an omnibus amendment, which was designed to incorporate all the measures from the various fisheries management plans. I just don't understand this conversation whatsoever. We need access in that area to mitigate habitat impacts, to mitigate the need for yellowtail, to maximize try to get near our optimum yield for scallops. I'm just amazed by this conversation.
Yeah.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Gib Brogan with Oceana. I understand the desire of the scallop industry to access this area. They've been salivating over it for almost a decade now and trying three or four different processes to get that access. But this is not the way to do it. The habitat process needs to work and do its considerations, have clear considerations of habitat issues, and then we can move on to scallop access. Conflating these two issues is a mistake. I think that adding this in right now assumes that the habitat area at the northern edge, the tip of closed area 2, is going to be reopened. I think that's a mistake. That is very clearly in the LISA analysis as a vulnerable area, and making that assumption is a mistake and shouldn't be a foregone conclusion. Yesterday afternoon, you heard Peter Hughes from the scallop industry tell you that it's a weed patch. It's nothing but seaweed, and we've got to mow the lawn so we can get to those scallops. It's not a weed patch. That's recovery. That's vertical life. That's what's out there. That's why it's habitat, is so that juvenile cod can use that as a nursery habitat. Not coincidentally, Georgia's Bank Cod right now has not had a good recruitment year in 20 years. 20 years since we've had an average recruitment year, and apparently we had one very recently. But we've got to look past scallops here. Making this assumption that that area is not important or is Peter Hughes' weed patch out there is a mistake for the overall work of this council. The habitat process needs to do its thing, and then we can talk about potentially accessing this area. As far as concern, Chairman Robbins had his concern about what happens if the area gets opened up through the habitat process, that we don't want it to be a free-for-all. There are plenty of ways for this council to put language in the omnibus, things that that area will remain closed until such a time, until the scallop FMP grants access. But those kind of safeguards can be built in much more easily, much more quickly than this right here, roping in the scallop committee. That's a big mistake. Anybody that's been through the scallop specification process at the PDT level and all the way up, looking at the timing issues, we haven't had a scallop spec package delivered on time in a number of years now. Roping that into this omnibus, I'm looking at months. I agree with Paul Howard that this is going to confuse it significantly. So we need to move this one quickly. Just one other question, and I think this came more from Rick Robbins and the safeguard about reopening areas, and I'm wondering whether more generally, as the omnibus looks at potentially opening areas that are closed for habitat purposes right now, should the omnibus include a policy on reopening areas so that we don't flip the switch and have it one day be closed as a habitat area and one day be opened? Get the best bang for the buck as we reopen those areas, whether it's controlled access. I know that there's consideration for dedicated habitat research areas, but there should be something else for more general moving things back into open area fisheries. So that's just something that I think should be considered, some kind of a policy there about reopening those areas. So that is my two cents on this one. I hope you'll vote it down, and we can move on and get this omnibus done. I've been involved with it since the get-go of this, and it's time to get it moving. Thanks.
Anyone else in the audience? Jeff?
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Members of the council, I'm Jeff Kalin with Lunds Fisheries. We're members of the Fisheries Survival Fund and have scallop permits full-time and part-time and some groundfish permits and a lot of other things. And, you know, if in fact, as the fellow from the Conservation Law Foundation said, this is about areas that should be open and which one should be closed, this motion is absolutely on target in terms of determining through the eyes of the Habitat Committee which areas could be open for future access areas so that we could harvest the scallops out there. I don't understand why this is such a difficult approach. Paul suggested that we do back-to-back frameworks, and I'm a little confused because I heard earlier that we couldn't do new allocations, which I assume we can't allocate to in a new access area unless there's amendment. But if we're going to do back-to-back frameworks, we allocate in frameworks all the time. So we need the help of the Habitat Committee to identify the areas where we can go in and take these scallops, and a subsequent framework could provide the allocations to us. And we've got a groundfish closed area technical team here that apparently we're waiting for information from them. Their focus is on gaining access for the groundfish industry. Why don't we have a scallop access area technical team with some kind of cross-fertilization between the scallop PDT and the Habitat Committee, but we need the Habitat Amendment to identify the areas that it would be appropriate for us to go in and scallop fish. And I don't, you know, I spent last week with scallops at the AP. This came up. Tuesday was the committee. This was discussed. Then we went to groundfish on Wednesday, and then we found out we couldn't do it that way. Then I had a day off. I went to the Herring Committee meeting. And then now we're here again all week. And what is it going to take to make this happen? I don't think it's not designed to slow down the habitat amendment at all. It just, we need the expertise of the Habitat PDT to identify the area, and then we can get the allocation out of another framework or something, or framework 23, if it can be done quickly enough. So we're frustrated by where we are with this conversation today, and I think this motion should be approved. It can be perfected. We can figure out how we're going to get there, but we need to start getting there. There's a lot of money tied up, and we appreciate the motion. Thank you.
Anyone else in the audience? Ron?
Thank you again, Mr. Chairman. Peter asked me to clarify his comments. He wasn't talking when he said weeds. He wasn't referring to vertical epiphone or anything. He was referring to the scallops. And what happened, if you remember, in closed area one, there was that technical problem between a framework and amendment. So we had that area that remains closed that was supposed to be open to scalloping as soon as we could get an amendment in place. And it took like 3 or 4 years. And what happened is a lot of those scallops in that area were gray meats, were not marketable. So we had a very, for every scallop harvested, we were killing another scallop. And those are called weeds. And at the northern edge, we've just had a survey out there, a VIMS effort, a HABCAM effort. There's 30 million pounds of scallops out there, but a lot of them are not marketable. They're weeds. And the loss is going to be to the country. I figured it's $1 billion every 5 years that area has been closed. And while those areas have been closed, we haven't had a successful cod year class. So there's a lot to be, all that's going to be in the conversations, but that's what he meant by weeds, the scallops that are there, that are dying, and that the market is lost.
Back to the council. David Pierce.
Yeah, I assume if this motion passes, then there'll be a charge to the scallop committee to work with the plant development team and the industry to develop access areas that would be considered in any area that might eventually be opened up as a consequence of the Habitat Omnibus Amendment. If it is determined in the interim that the Habitat Omnibus Amendment is inappropriate to actually implement those access areas, then perhaps we could decide at that time to just have another scallop framework developed, and that would then do the job and would be timed appropriately so that it would be ready to go when the Habitat Omnibus Amendment is eventually implemented. So that's the way I see this unfolding. And if it doesn't, if that's how it unfolds, then I would vote for this motion.
Anyone else? Doug Grout and Dave Gaisel.
We heard earlier today when we were discussing groundfish that the measure that we put in to have considered for the groundfish closed area modifications through sector plans was going to delay analysis needed for the Habitat Amendment. I heard Tom indicate that, I believe. My question is, if we include this in, is this where we have to suddenly be analyzing scallop access areas in this plan? Is that going to delay the Habitat Amendment again? I just would like some input from staff on that.
Paul. Thank you, Mr. Chairman. If you look at the timelines that are in your binder, we're now talking about June implementation without this motion. Now, I know that's unacceptable, but in order for us to do NEPA correctly and analyze groundfish, scallops, habitat, it's going to take, we've got to develop a DEIS, submit it. It's usually reviewed in a month or so. And then you've got 7 months of, no, it's, yeah, then you've got hearings and everything and 7 months of review before it's implemented. So we're talking early 2014. So if the expectation is that there'll be scallop access during 2013, I don't know how that can happen. I don't like being the bearer of bad news, but it's in the document. 2013 is out. We've got huge NEPA requirements that we have to meet.
Thank you for that, because it does help me in how I'm going to vote on this. And I also think we need to think carefully about scallop access areas the same way we need to think carefully about removing groundfish closed areas, particularly in closed area 2, because of some of the issues that I raised earlier concerning another species. This is ecosystem interactions. We're not just talking about species that are managed by this council. We have large amounts of buried females out in that area, and it needs to be addressed in a very careful manner. I think there is a mechanism to have the scallop industry have access to this. I think they're working on it, but until those safeguards are in place to try and protect the lobster resource out there while allowing access to the scallop population, I think we have to go through this very carefully. So I'm not going to support this motion. Dave Gatham.
Yeah, I think there's two issues embedded in this motion, and that's why we're in such a mess. Development of scallop access areas is something I think the Habitat Committee can do. The allocation, I don't think the Habitat Committee can do it. The Habitat Committee did not scope for that. I think that's pretty much a fact. So the way out of this to me is to split this up somehow and have the scallop committee do an allocation amendment. Everybody seems to agree allocations have to be done in an amendment, and that's why they're trying to pack it in here, because this is an amendment. You know, they can get to work on scoping that and doing it in January and February and have it set up in such a way that it comes in concurrently with completion of the habitat amendment. But I also agree with Paul that either any one of these processes is not going to get you in there in 2013. I mean, I think people have to be realistic here. That you know, the 60 days for this, 90 days for that, the reviews, the everything else. Once this habitat amendment is voted, it's got to go to public hearing. There's no way. So, you know, as I said earlier today, it's people better find other methods of doing business here. So, somebody makes a motion to split this up somehow, I might vote for it. But if it stays as a combined package, I'm going to vote against it.
Peter Kendall.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I was really confused, and then Doug's question got to my point, and Paul clarified it. With Dave bringing that up, I saw it as two separate things, too. If you were to take out the allocations, this question's to Paul again, would that still slow it down in time so it couldn't be analyzed for 2013?
No.
It would still be the same timeline.
But it's still 2014.
Yeah, so separating it out still isn't going to help it.
Tom Dempsey.
Just a point of clarification. I think we're sort of getting confused on two interpretations or two uses of the term allocation. Basically, this is just setting the access areas and then defining the trip limit for those access areas. Nobody's permit changes, whereas an actual allocation of a privilege has to go through an amendment. We do allocations to these access areas and frameworks all the time. In fact, one of the standing things that we consider in every framework is whether the existing access areas are appropriate, whether new ones should be formed, and if so, where they should be and what the allocation / trip limit should be in there. So we do this in a framework all the time. I'm concerned about the timeline. I think Paul's comment suggesting that, where we're going to end up on this were good ones and informative. I just want to make that distinction because there are sort of two uses of the term allocation. We can definitely allocate to an access area and a framework.
Further discussion? I'm going to call the question. All those in favor of the motion, so indicate.
8 in favor. Opposed? Hold them back up again, please. 1, 2, 3. Okay. Okay. We're. Can we go back to those in favor, please? I'm sorry. 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7, 8. Okay. And opposed. 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7, 8, 9. Yeah, you were correct. Okay. 8 in favor, 9 opposed. That's 17 votes with no abstentions. The motion fails. Mary Beth.
So, you know, I do understand a lot of the concerns that people had about this, and I'd also like to go back to what Drew's comment was. We all know what the issue is. We just need to figure out how to get it done. And so my take on this is that, you know, people weren't comfortable with this approach, and we still need to get it done. So there are other ways to view it, and under our priority discussion, we could talk some more about the ways to get it done. But I think the other piece is that we still need to move this amendment as quickly as we can, and perhaps in light of the scallop needs and the fact that there is so much economic loss, we should encourage the scallop PDT to be working with the Habitat PDT a little bit on some of the boundaries, particularly in closed area two. So if people are comfortable with that, I think we could move on from this topic. And I have another motion to offer relative to the omnibus amendment, and Karen has it. She can put it on the screen, and I will read it. So I would move the omnibus habitat amendment on a faster timeline, and the council will, one, limit the dedicated habitat research area alternatives in the omnibus amendment to one area in the current Western Gulf of Maine and one area in closed area one. Two, schedule a one-day council meeting following the Habitat Advisors PDT meeting to develop and finalize area management alternatives. And three, move the document out to public hearings as soon as possible. We have, if I get a second, I'll provide some rationale.
Seconded by Terry Stockwell.
So the development of this amendment has been going on for a very long time, and while I haven't been on the council the entire time, I was a habitat advisor in phase one, so I'm pretty clear on where we've been and where we're going. And we just need to move this. We can't add more stuff. We just need to deal with what's in the document, figure out how we're going to manage the areas, and finish the analysis and take it out to public hearing. The current timeline would have us submitting this document in about a year and a half. We would be taking final action on it in November of 2013 or somewhere thereabouts. We just can't keep doing this. I think that John Bullitt made comments earlier about, you know, it's an ongoing process. It's not like we're never going to do habitat again. You know, things that aren't done, put them on the shelf for the next action. Finish this action. Start another action right away, whichever. But I think people are very frustrated with our progress on this, and we just need to move it along.
Is the intent of this motion to say that with the groundfish closed areas, if they make it in time, they make it in time? If not, they're in a separate action? I don't see them referred to.
Well, that's a good question. I looked at the next steps, which is the last slide on Michelle's presentation. And relative to the groundfish closed areas and the action we took on Framework 48, I wasn't clear what remains to be considered. Why do we need to further consider mortality closures in the habitat amendment? Is there any reason we do?
Tom.
Well, there's a lot of reasons to consider area management in this action. And you'll notice I was careful to avoid using the term mortality closures. Because there are a lot of reasons that the Groundfish Committee has been advised on, is considered, and will get a choice to work through for using area management. Spawning closures, for example. There may be issues with respect to gear closures. There may be protected species issues. We provided the committee in January a table of about 15 or 16 things. The closed area technical team has been working to better refine those, and we're hoping to bring to the committee, maybe at the next committee meeting, some ideas to focus what sorts of uses of areas that the committee wants to pursue. So, there's a lot of reasons to consider this besides just the use of mortality closures.
Mary Beth.
So if I could follow up, the way that Tom just described that, those strategies would be the area management alternatives. And so what I suggest is that following this joint PDT-AP meeting, that we schedule a council meeting, one-day council meeting, and flesh out exactly what those alternatives are. And I now Tom raises this issue, and I think this is one of timing. So this motion is not specific to when this full council meeting would take place. I'm assuming if we have this list of area management alternatives, we need to press along as quickly as we can, and I'd like to see us have this meeting before the end of the year. So I think this motion would not preclude what Tom describes.
Tom?
I mean, maybe we should ask Andy, but my impression that from conversations we've had earlier that I would not expect that work to be ready in time for a meeting by the end of the year, particularly with the work on Framework 48 going on. I mean, I just, first off, I don't know that the committee has time to devote to it, let alone the closed area technical team.
Terry.
Yeah, thank you, Mr. Chairman. From the groundfish perspective, as soon as possible addresses that issue for me. But I've listened long and hard all week long on the wide range of comments underscoring the need to expedite the process and get this omnibus out the door. At the last Habitat Committee meeting, the committee really made huge forward progress and proposed some adverse effects minimization alternatives. And it's solely based on the SASE model. The process has kept us churning for however many years. But frankly, I was very surprised that motion was not on today's agenda. It was a huge deal to the committee. It's a huge deal to the public. It's going to take a significant amount of discussion to move it ahead. I support this motion. I think it's going to help force us to focus to fully address all the issues that remain unfinished in the amendment, to get the industry the relief and to provide mitigation for both the groundfish and scallop effort. And without focusing on this and putting kind of all hands on deck, like, you know, we've, I think, you know, John, when you began your position, you said we have an emergency situation. This is part of the emergency. So that's why I support the motion on the board.
Dave Preble.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. A couple of things. First of all, as far as that last motion not being put in front of the council today, it was merely because the committee did not table the ground cable length, and that has to go before the AP. They voted to put it before the AP. That's the only reason that wasn't on today, because we've got the AP meeting the week after next in order to get their input on it. But I agree that we need to get that done. As far as this is concerned, I like the idea here. I'm not sure. We need a break. I need to talk to Michelle and figure out a couple of things about this. Can we take a short break?
We'll take a 10-minute break and then come back and continue on, because we have still a long way to go. The groundfish PDT and the committee to bring that forth to the council in January. John Bullard.
I can't see it there, but I think Dave said ask the regional administrator. I think maybe the agency is better, because I think the resources may be at the science center as well as the regional office. So agency may be a better word.
Yep. Paul Howard, then Dave Preble.
Yeah, just real quickly, thanks, Mr. Chairman. Dave, you mentioned a legal requirement for dedicated habitat research areas. I'm not aware of a legal requirement. I'm aware of a requirement that we scoped to consider it, and I don't see any problem with considering and rejecting. I don't think we're legally bound to do it at this time, but I may be wrong.
Mary Beth.
I had some similar thoughts, and perhaps what Dave was referring to is the goals and objectives in the amendment. And you simply, if you amend your goals and objectives, that's all you need to do to meet that. I put number one in because when I look at the document, I don't see any alternatives for dedicated habitat research areas. I did read the meeting summary, and there was discussion at the meeting. But in my mind, if you haven't got alternatives yet, then that's time-consuming. And what we're trying to do is speed things up. I put in these two options because I know that they've been fleshed out a little bit more in some discussions, and they aren't specific because I haven't been part of those discussions. But, I mean, the alternative is take them all out. Don't do them at all. I think people would be unhappy by that. These two areas have been closed for a long period of time, so I'm assuming that wouldn't take the level of analysis that entirely new ones would. And it says stop. That's enough. The other alternative is just to take them out. If Andy is going to, his team is going to be ready to go in January. If we can have all that information come forward to both the Habitat Committee and the Groundfish Committee, and have recommendations and add a day to our January Council meeting that's nothing but habitat, in which we say, okay, these are the finalized alternatives in this document. We're taking it out to public hearing. That's way better than the current timeline that the habitat amendment is in our binder, which would have us not making those decisions until the end of the year. I'd rather do it in the beginning of the year. We need to take some steps here. We need to move this along. And if anybody has some better ideas, I'm open to that. But so far, all I'm hearing is, we've got to keep with this timeline, do it this way. Well, I think people are very unhappy with that. We need to figure out how to do it faster, so this is an option.
Dave Preble.
Yeah, thank you. And as I said before, I'm thoroughly on board with that idea. And I think that we need to be immediately scoping through the next 2 months, if we have to, 3 months, in order to make sure that we can have the kind of meetings that we need at the times when we need them, rather than having to wait through that whole process. And the idea of having one-day committee meetings, I agree with Mary Beth completely on. I mean, not committee, council meetings. I agree with Mary Beth completely on that. We're going to need at least one, maybe two of those that are not on the schedule at this time. As far as the DHRAs, they are on there are a couple of places where they're referenced. There's reference to them in Magnuson. I don't have that in front of me. But there's also the rules that were put in place to administer the 98 law on page 2378 of the Federal Register. I have that in front of me. The evaluation should establish research closure areas or other measures to evaluate the impact or other measures to evaluate the impacts of fishing activities on EFH. We need to be able to monitor the actions that we take so that 5 years down the line we can't get into this situation where we have closures that 5-10 years later we don't know if they worked or not. That's just not acceptable. We have to be able to measure the effects of what we do, and we have not done that in the past, and that is, in fact, now a requirement. I'll find it in Magnuson. I've got it in here somewhere. But at any rate, the DHRA is just simply not a time-limiting factor right now. In fact, Vito was up here a little while ago. They've got some in line, and there's another one that isn't mentioned up here that's an area that's been long closed. It isn't going to be opened, and that isn't mentioned in here. And that all has to be – this is off the fly. This has got to be refined in order to get it right. So I can't support it right now, but I like the idea. But I can't support this the way it is.
David Pierce.
Well, I assume we're working on the motion that's before us and not the perfected motion that has a question mark next to it. So there is no perfection on this motion, correct? Okay. And I would there's no perfection on this motion. We're dealing with the one that's on the screen right now. I would suggest that we need to be respectful of the Stellwagen Bank National Marine Sanctuary in terms of what they are doing in concert with the Habitat Committee and also with the fishing industry. And I say that because right now the language says to one area in the current Western Gulf of Maine. I assume that means the current Western Gulf of Maine closure. And I believe that the Sanctuary Office is looking at a slight modification to that, once again working with the fishing industry. So I could support this with this motion with one modification, and that would be to provide us with some flexibility regarding the Western Gulf of Maine. So I would move to amend just to strike the word current.
Make it a friendly.
Okay. I think Mary Beth said that it's a friendly.
Yes.
So Mary Beth is considering that to be a friendly. Just strike the word current. Okay, one area in the Western. That doesn't.
Okay. Doug Grout. Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I, as a member of the Habitat Committee, I do think we're getting a little bit too hung up on these dedicated habitat research areas. And talking with Michelle, at our last meeting, we were going to have those options ready for the next Habitat Committee meeting in October / November, whenever that is. And talking to Michelle at the break, they're going to be ready for us to make decisions at that meeting, which we could then bring to the council at whatever subsequent council meeting. Dave was right. The limiting factor here is looking at having the ground fish closed areas looked at, and it sounds like we will have that by the January council meeting. What I see is that one-day council meeting, which I think is a good idea, too, because of such a high importance, something that we think this council has stated many, many times is the top importance. Maybe that could come between the January and April council meeting to try and expedite it, depending on what happens in January. But the habitat research areas, we're going to make a decision on them in October, November. The groundfish closed area analysis is going to happen is going to be presented to us in January. So that's when we need to start trying to expedite things. Limiting us to how many we're going to have, we may decide to have zero. We may decide to have three. It doesn't make any difference. We're going to make a decision that we will bring to the council here at our October-November meeting. Tom Dempsey.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I think Doug makes a lot of sense, and I'm certainly not prepared to determine. I don't think any of us really are, whether one's needed, two's needed, where they should be. I just don't feel like I know enough to make that decision. I do agree with Doug also that scheduling a one-day full dedicated meeting to deal with this as soon as possible, that makes perfect sense, and I have no problem with the third bullet. So with that in mind, I bring a motion to amend and simply eliminate the first bullet there.
You're seconding that, Dave? We'll let you second it, Matt. He's already up there. Yes, Dave.
Yeah, what that leaves is the scheduling of the one-day council meeting, and this says that it would be following the Habitat Advisors PDT meeting. Does that mean, I don't know what that means, does that mean the one on the 11th of October? I'm not sure what that means. And I guess
after that meeting.
So it can be a month or two after that. Okay. If it's better to have it in late January, as Doug was saying, I think Doug makes an excellent point. Do it when we can make it work. I mean, the way this has been written, it doesn't help us. We need to move fast, and all this thing does is hobble us. So I think that Tom's amendment is a good one.
Mary Beth.
Well, going through the process of choosing the habitat research areas, it can be done rather quickly. I think a lot of the work, has been presented to the Habitat Committee on some of the parameters around that. But the more alternatives you add to the document, the longer it takes to get done. It's the analysis. How long does the analysis take if you have, four different alternatives for habitat research areas? That's the part that I'm concerned about, not the committee making, choices on it. It's the workload that goes into having a document ready to go, having a document that's ready to go out to public hearings. And I think that, my preference would have been for this meeting to happen more quickly than January. But then when you mention April, it's like, again, let's add a few more months. And we'll just be on the regular timeline that we're on now that nobody finds acceptable, making final decisions in November. So I prefer personally, my preference would be to take them out, not do them, stop. Let's work on the workload that we have before us and not bother with dedicated habitat research areas at all. However, I think that people who have been working on it and feel that this is important would be very disappointed by that. So that is why I put number one in there. So I don't support the proposed amendment.
Dave Gatham.
Yeah, I think my question's for Tom. I'm actually more concerned with the second bullet, because scheduling a one-day council meeting, if we haven't got the groundfish analysis done, is basically a waste of a day. So my major concern with this motion is that we have tried very carefully to keep habitat and groundfish together. That the habitat area is closed, when the groundfish area is open, to keep everybody's feet to the fire here. And if we get into a situation where habitat area is closed before groundfish area is open, you want to talk about something that's going to slow this down. It'll screech right to a halt right then and there, because the industry will dig its heels in and never budge. So, again, my question to him is, our groundfish analysis is not going to be done till the same time as Andy's work. Is that the end of January? Is that what we're looking at?
Yes.
Okay.
I think what Andy said was ready for the January council meeting. I guess I'm a little unclear here on what we mean by area management alternatives. If the idea here is to finally come out with, and forgive me if you've already done this, Michelle, because I've lost track the last couple of weeks. If you're talking about holding this meeting to come up with what the habitat issues are, then this might actually be helpful. But I don't know that, we're going to have, we certainly won't have the groundfish piece of this ready in time for the Habitat Advisors PDT meeting in November or October.
It's in October. So my personal preference, quite frankly, would be to have the whole thing withdrawn and let us get on with doing our work. But, that's up to the maker and seconder of the motion or the amended motion or something. We always do our best work after 5 at night, and it looks like we're headed for that yet again.
Matt?
I think there's another issue involved in this, that we've got a research priority, we've got changing closed areas, and this is one instance where we've got industry, the sanctuary, and the council and the services working together. I think that's an important initiative. I think we need to simply circumvent that right now would be, I just think it sets a wrong tone. It doesn't acknowledge the importance of industry input into this research agenda and protocol. I just think it would be not only offensive but counterproductive.
Peter Campbell.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. To Mary Beth's point, I would like to ask Michelle and Andy, how much time, extra time is that if there are multiple alternatives to research areas? Is that going to slow it down even more?
So the guidance that the Habitat Committee has given to the PDT is that they want to see research areas that sort of capitalize and piggyback on habitat management areas that we're already analyzing. So with the exception of maybe the idea of a research area in and around closed area one. Everything that's on the table as far as the PDT is concerned, which we're going to talk about at that meeting on the 10th, is in areas that we're already analyzing and evaluating and looking at anyway. So, yes, there is additional work associated with, you know, doing a full evaluation of each new dedicated habitat research area, but they're in areas we're studying, characterizing, and assessing the costs and benefits of anyhow. So I think it's somewhat marginal.
Anyone else?
Well, just a follow-up to that. I see Andy raising his hand, too. So that means that's all going to be analyzed and presented to us by the January council meeting?
In terms of habitat research areas, I don't think it makes much difference to the groundfish conservation analysis relative to the habitat areas and reopening areas that exist now. What would I think this motion partly addresses another concern, though, that at the present time you have habitat management areas that have been identified by the SASE model and the habitat committee, but they really haven't been codified into a set of alternatives. Obviously, one alternative is a status quo, and another alternative is all of the areas together. But there's variations in between. At the present time, the groundfish effort, the technical team, wouldn't know which habitat management alternatives to analyze because they have not been effectively identified yet. So if this helps that process a little bit, that would help the technical team work as well.
Anyone else? Terry.
Yeah, thank you, Mr. Chairman. This has been a very good discussion. I'm comfortable with the motion to amend because we have this date locked in with the AP and the PDT. The committee did limit the dedicated research areas to three. It's one more than the two that was in the original motion. Industry that was present at that committee meeting had already had ideas they wanted to put on the table. I don't think that is going to add any more time, and it probably will make a more complete document.
Anyone else? Call the question. All those in favor of the motion to amend. 14. Opposed. 2. Abstention. 0. The motion to amend carries. We're on the main motion as amended. Further discussion. Paul Howard.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Just to get the clear intent, even if the groundfish work isn't done, we're going to have a one-day council meeting following.
Mary Beth.
Well, in our back and forth with staff and their timeline, and because there's no date specific here, and the meeting is to choose the area management alternatives, if they're ready to go in January, I think we should sync those things up so we're doing it all together. So it seems like that would be all right. I mean, because this is not date specific.
And
January would, I mean, to me December is better, next week is better, but if that's the best we can do, then that's still moving things along much faster than the current timeline. So.
Anything further? Dave Gaetham.
I hate to belabor, but it would seem to me to have it say that then after the groundfish, the closed area technical committee or whatever has completed its work, something like that, so that we know exactly when we're scheduling this and what it is we're gonna do. I just don't want to have a one-day council meeting and not be doing something substantive. You know, having a one-day council meeting to do the habitat alternatives, I don't think is substantive. I think we can do that in far less than a day to deal with the groundfish mortality closures and the habitat areas. That's probably at least a day. So, personally, I'd like to see this be a little more specific, or actually a lot more specific than it is.
I mean, right at the moment, it would make sense to add a day to the January meeting that is dedicated to this one thing.
Then it seems to me it should say that so that we're clear. As long as I have the floor, I think that would also set a kind of a time certain deadline for staff that you know you got to have it ready by then, and let everybody else know as well that momentous things are going to happen on this day in January.
Is that all right with those making this motion to be? Okay, without objection. Anything further? Call the question. All those in favor of the motion as amended. 16 in favor. Opposed? Abstentions? Motion carries. No. Read my lips. No. Tom, what do you got?
I was hoping that we could actually pass a motion that everybody would agree on and feel good about. And with that in mind, and understanding that we haven't done a great job of that yet today, I'm going to take a crack at it. I sent Karen the language, I think. This would be to move to include as alternatives in the next available framework to the Scallop FMP the consideration and potential creation of new access areas and existing habitat closures on Georgia's Bank, should those areas be modified or eliminated in the Habitat Omnibus Amendment. This consideration would be based on survey information and would follow the existing protocols for the creation of new rotational access areas and associated allocations. If I get a second, I'll quickly speak to that. Great. So I don't think I need to say too much. We clearly all agree that we want the Habitat Omnibus to do its work. We clearly all agree that as soon as possible, should areas become available, we want the scallopers to be able to get in there, and we don't want to undermine the resource by having a free-for-all. So I think this gets it done using our existing process and puts it in the next framework.
Audience, back to the council. PK?
Would you mind, as a friendly, just changing that allocations to trip limits?
The one thing with allocations is both trip limits and then the overall amount based on survey information. Dee could probably help me with the words, but I do think a rotational access area needs an overall amount, and then that's broken down into trips, and I think we refer to those as allocations. That's why I use the term here.
Anyone else on the council? Call the question. All those in favor? 16. Motion carries. Anything else on habitat, Dave?
I think we finally kicked and scrabbled and got to where we need to be. So that's the end of the habitat report.
Thank you. And thank you, Michelle, for all of your work. Our next item, are we going on to priorities now? Paul Howard.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. And tab one, or I think it's item number five.
Is it?